Welcome back to the Better Know a Lawyer podcast. Today I'm talking about restraining orders, how to get them if you want them, and how to fight them if you don't. Stay tuned.
Thanks for tuning in. Host Noah Weil is a licensed attorney admitted to practice in Washington State and the Federal Court of the Western District of Washington. Some guests on this program may be licensed attorneys as well. However, the discussion on this podcast is intended to be informative only and is not a substitute for legal advice for your particular situation. The information may be right or may be wrong. Changing laws and the laws of individual states mean the information presented here may not be accurate. But regardless, and this part is important, neither Noah nor any guest here is your lawyer. If you need a lawyer for your individual situation, you should consult and retain your own attorney.
This week's topic is about the restraining orders. One person is restrained from contacting another person. And they're actually quite common. There's a lot of instances where they come up. And I have found that people, normal people who don't get in trouble much, still come across protection orders, either because they're the subject of one or because they need to get one. I've been surprised by this. I wrote a blog post a number of years ago about restraining orders, and it's been one of my most popular ones. I still get a lot of contact by it. People just get involved in the courts. It's one of the more common ways of doing it besides traffic tickets and divorces. And there's not a whole lot of information out there. The purpose of a restraining order is to keep somebody safe. And that means you have to make a showing that they're in danger. The ways a restraining order can be imposed on somebody are basically threefold. Number one, they can come up in a divorce case. If during a divorce proceeding, one of the spouses accuses the other of being violent to them or their children, the divorce judge can restrain the contact of the threatening person. It's not something I deal with because I don't deal with divorces, but I've been told by the family law attorneys that it does come up now and then. The second common way that a restraining order can come up, and this one I see a lot, is in a criminal case. And it goes like this. Somebody is arrested for domestic violence. They're brought in front of the judge. They're arraigned, which means they're told what the charges are, usually domestic violence, assault of some kind. And then there's a condition of release that they not have contact with the person they're alleged to have assaulted. Sometimes the victim or alleged victim shows up to court the next day and says, I'm really afraid. I want that person to stay away from me. And the judge says, okay, I'm going to order him to stay away from you and your residence and not contact you by any means. Sometimes the alleged victim shows up and says, I'm not afraid. It was a misunderstanding, and I really don't want an order imposed on him or her, but usually him. And they just say, okay, thank you for showing up. I'm still going to impose an order preventing him from contacting you in any way. This could be a really big deal for families. Last week, I had talked to Officer Eric Mitchell, and we talked a lot about domestic violence. And he said he didn't have a lot of discretion to arrest people when a domestic violence call happens. Somebody is usually going to end up in handcuffs. And that's the problem with this process, is that it's kind of an on-rail situation. Someone calls 911, says there's been fighting noises in the apartment, the police show up, somebody's being arrested, that person is going to be put in jail that day, then they're going to be in front of a judge, and then the judge is more often than not going to order them not to have any contact with their spouse. Of course, these orders have value when there's been actual violence or a history of violence, but often enough, the court just does a better safe than sorry thing, sees that somebody is arrested for domestic violence, and wants to perpetuate making sure that people are safe by making sure they don't stay together. So if it's a husband and wife, and the husband's accused of assaulting his wife, that means the husband can't go home. He has to find some other place to live. Hopefully he has a friend or a relative nearby that'll let him crash there while a case is pending. And hopefully, if he can't, he can afford a hotel or some temporary housing. But you can see that when you're ordered to be away from your home, it can be very disruptive. And that's not even talking about the kids, who sometimes are allowed to have contact with their parents, sometimes not. And either way, the transfer of children or somebody who's suddenly a single parent, it could be a very big deal for families. In a criminal case, when an order, a no-contact order, is imposed, and neither the defendant nor the alleged victim want the order, usually, if the person who is restrained does everything right and doesn't contact the person, the court will modify it or lift it down the road. And I say usually because the court has the complete discretion. But technically, the court doesn't have to order it in the first place. It's just extremely rare in my experience where they won't, because they don't want to be, they don't want to get on the front page of the papers where they knew of a domestic violence situation and they didn't do anything to protect the victim and she ends up, you know, dead or in the hospital. So they play it safe and they figure if the criminal case doesn't go anywhere, no harm done, they're back together. The reality is there can often be a lot of harm done. The orders can be modified, and as part of my work with my clients, sometimes just getting in front of that judge and asking for the family to be reunited. The third way that a restraining order can come about is its own legal proceeding, which is to say no one is charged with a crime, but the person who feels threatened can go to a court and request a restraining order against somebody else. By law, the procedures for doing this are really simple. They cost nothing or next to nothing to acquire. There are people at the court to help get this accomplished, and forms that are very simple to fill out for the person who feels threatened to get protection. And that's probably as it should be, because we don't want somebody to need to get a lawyer if they feel threatened, or to have a legal degree or a legal education to be safe. We want the courts to protect vulnerable people. However, the ease in which these orders can be obtained can make them open for abuse too. I'll talk a little bit more about the ways protection orders can be abused, but first I want to talk about, if you do need one, what's the process of getting one? You need to get a form from the court, usually the county court nearest to you. King County, there's a bunch of different courthouses, but some of the smaller counties, there might have to be a specific place. But there should be pre-printed forms. In fact, by law, the court has to make them available for people. The form requests basically two things: the information of the person to be restrained and why the court should restrain them from contacting you. I've seen a lot of these petitions, both helping people draft them and opposing them. And the biggest mistake people make when asking for a protection order is this speculation. They don't talk so much about incidences, they talk about feelings and motivations. So, for example, a good description of why this person's a danger would be, on October 10th, he slapped me in front of my son, and then he broke my cell phone, and then he left. That's a very concrete event, date, what happened, that kind of thing. And you can say how it made you feel. After he slapped me, I was hurt, and I felt scared. That's all legitimate. But you'll see some petitions that say, I think he's going to hit me. I'm concerned that he's going to get his friends together and beat me up. He's threatened to do it before, but I don't know when exactly. Things that are just a little more muddled or a little more speculative, the court's not going to take it seriously. If you want to get a petition or protection order, the best thing to do is have a lot of incidents. You don't need a lot. You can do it with one. But the more incidents that occur, the more likely it'll be granted. And if you have anybody who has seen the incidences or has seen the effects of them, for example, a nurse that treated your injuries, or a neighbor or a friend who heard shouting or saw violence, getting statements from them, it's all very strong. The court takes a petition and does one of three things. They can either dismiss the petition outright and say, you haven't alleged enough for me to go any farther with this, or say, you've alleged some things, so we're going to have a hearing in 2 weeks to see whether your request should be granted, but that's it. You two are still free to contact each other until that hearing in 2 weeks. Or, and this is what you really want, when you get a protection order, when you're requesting a protection order, is the judge says, we're going to have a hearing in 2 weeks about whether this order should be put in place permanently, but in the meantime, that person is not allowed to contact you at all. It's a temporary order that lasts for 2 weeks, but it goes into effect immediately, or as soon as practicable. The other big mistake that people make when they get these petitions, or when they get the temporary orders, even when they just get the hearing in 2 weeks, is they don't serve the person. The way our court rules work, the other side, the defendant, has to know these proceedings exist and what they're restrained from doing. And it's not so much that the person is told by an email or by a phone call, hey, there's this court date coming up and you better show up. It's called personal service. The documents that were filed with the courts, all of them have to be given to the person who is the defendant. And it has to be done by somebody who is not the plaintiff, not the person actually asking for it. So in these civil protection orders, when you request one directly from the court, generally the sheriff's department will serve it for you as long as you know the name and address and such of the person who's going to receive it. But you need to get that proof of service, proof for the court that the person did receive all the information of why the order is being sought against them. Because if they don't receive it, it's not fair for them to be subject to it. Now the question might be for you, if you're ever subject to one of these, why do you care? Let's say it's a perfect stranger or an ex, somebody you just have no interest in having contact with at all. Do you care if this order is put in place against you? And the answer is yes. Having an order against you has a lot of collateral consequences. For one, it can affect your firearm rights. You may not be able to have a weapons permit if you've been the subject of a restraining order. If you want to vacate or expunge crimes, the court will look at restraining orders you've had against you, and they might impact your ability to get those things off your record. Sometimes for background checks for jobs or for housing, being the subject of a restraining order can be a disqualifying event. And possibly the most important thing, it exposes you to criminal liability. If you're alleged to have violated the order that tells you to stay away from somebody, you could be arrested. That's a separate crime. And this really comes up a lot in criminal cases. I'll have an assault case, and I'm not even thinking of a specific example because this happens way too often for my taste, but I'll have a criminal assault case, a domestic violence case, and there'll be a restraining order put against somebody. And the case has a lot of holes, like a lot of problems, and we're either going to go to trial on it or the prosecutor is going to dismiss it. But the person who is restrained, the defendant, doesn't wait for the judge to modify the order, for the case to be dismissed, and, you know, calls his girlfriend or whatever, usually text messages, so it's a real clean record. And then the prosecutor says, well, we're going to charge your guy with violating a no-contact order, and, you know, good luck with that one, because we have a pretty slammed-up case. And what ends up happening is the person has a much worse situation to deal with. It might mean that they plead guilty to something when they would have been able to get all the charges dismissed otherwise. Even if the original case is just garbage, even if it's proved that the person was lying about everything, violating a no-contact order is an independent charge, completely separate from the first one. So whatever happens with the first one is irrelevant for the second one. And frankly, those violating no-contact order cases are a lot harder to beat because usually the facts are pretty cut and dry. So I tell them, and I give the same spiel every time, don't call her, don't text her, don't email her, don't have your friend call her, don't get anywhere near her while this case is pending. Once the case is done, the order goes away. But until then, you need to stay far away because you are very exposed to criminal liability. And it's true for civil things, too. Once you have officially received notice of that order, you are exposed to criminal charges. She can say, he contacted me against the order, and now you have to defend yourself. And if you can't defend yourself, you're facing potential jail time. It's a big deal. So even people who don't want orders against them, or don't care necessarily about the orders against them, I think they should still fight it. It's just so much exposure, so much collateral consequences, it's worth fighting. So how do you fight someone saying that you're a threat to them? Well, a lot of it depends on the individual circumstances. But here's the essence of it. The judge wants to keep everybody safe. As I said, they don't want to be in the papers for having the opportunity to keep two people apart and not doing anything about it. So assuming that the allegations are untrue or exaggerated, the person who is fighting against having the order placed against them has got to seem calm and credible. Why is this other person saying these things that aren't true? Why should the court not grant an order restraining somebody? Because it's a big deal. It's restraining someone's liberty, saying you can't go to this place, you can't talk to this person. That's not our normal society. It's a thing when a judge signs a piece of paper that says you are not allowed to do something. A lot of the times, one side or both sides won't have lawyers. I'll see this in court all the time. And they're just screaming at each other, you're lying, no, you're lying. What do you think the judge is going to do when he sees two groups of people screaming at each other in open court? He's going to grant the order. All he's going to see is these people have a real history. They can't be in the same room together. Whoever had requested the order first, it doesn't matter. The person who is the defendant is going to be restrained because clearly they're not mature enough to be around each other. So when you're a defendant in a protection order, it's so important that you just always remain calm, never rise to the bait of an emotional response, don't interrupt the other person, just let them say their case and just say, judge, it's just not the case, it's not true. Technically, the person who's asking for the order has the burden of proof, but in reality, it's really it's really hard to not get the order unless you have some ways to prove you're innocent of the allegations. I'm thinking of a few cases that I've done with these restraining orders. One case I had a while back was a situation with two neighbors. And it's tough with neighbors because you can't really tell one person to stay 500 feet away from the other person because that's way past their property line. And the judge is not going to evict somebody from their home unless they're, you know, living in the same home and they're intimate partners. But these were just two neighbors that just had a real problem. And it was actually interesting because one of the neighbor's dog had bit the other neighbor's son. And the person who was bit sued them, and there was a lot of legal brouhaha. So there was a motivation for the people with the dog to lie, and we had to make that clear. I was representing the people who, you know, were not lying. And so they brought this restraining order against my clients, saying that the family was harassing them, harassing the dog, and that they should make no contact with them, with their family. And this was a big deal because, again, it exposed this family to police contact, to criminal charges. If the order had been placed against them, they could have been, at any time, gotten visits from the police when the family with the dog had said, oh, yeah, they came over and harassed us. And they would have to, you know, show receipts or an alibi or something. That didn't come to case. It would be too stressful to live under like that. They told me, and I believed them, that they would basically have to move. So we went to court, and we had a full hearing. It was basically a miniature trial. And they were a very, very strange group. They denied the dog biting their kid ever, and we had documentation on that. And they would never answer my questions directly. And it basically, on the one side, they didn't look credible because they didn't come looking to tell the truth. They had an agenda. And so that was certainly helpful for us. But then I also talked about the effects a restraining order would have on my clients for their employment because they both had some security issues at their work. And the judge ultimately agreed and did grant the order against them and actually granted an order restraining the other family from contacting my clients, which is something we asked for. I didn't know we would necessarily get it. Being able to show why, in this case, granting the order was not in the best interest of the court, when usually it is in the best interest of the court just to keep people apart, and that these people were incredible, went a long way. And another case where a tenant had gotten a protection order against his landlord. The tenant was way behind in his rent and was looking to get kicked out. And to stave off that process, we got a protection order restraining the landlord from basically getting near his unit. And it was a big deal. And this guy was what I would call a professional tenant. You know, he used a lot of tricks to try to stay in a place longer than he could afford or that he was allowed to be there. But this was a thing, you know, for the same reasons. He could have called the police and said, she's harassing me against this order. These orders go into all the criminal databases around the state. If a judge signs it, the police will know about it and can pull it up anytime. So an accusation that someone's violating an order is taken seriously by the police, and they have all the information to follow up on it. We put up some briefing against this guy. He didn't have a lawyer. I don't know if he couldn't afford one or just no one would take his case, but we basically said it's not harassment to get evicted when you can't pay your rent. This is an abusive process. And it was. It was clearly an abusive process. And the judge agreed and did not grant the order restraining my client. And that was nice. But I asked for him to pay for my client's lawyer fees, pay for my fees, because it was such a waste that my client had to show up for court at all for this. It's basically a scam. But the judge didn't do that. Just said they didn't make their burden of proof, and so the whole case is dismissed. And I'm told the guy left the apartment soon thereafter. I don't want them all, but sometimes there are creative remedies. I know one case I had where a client had machines in his house that were producing these horrible sounds, these high-pitched screeching sounds, and the neighbors were sick of it. I mean, it was giving them headaches. So they brought a restraining order, basically restraining my client from running these machines and disturbing their enjoyment and their sanctity of their own houses, because these were loud, loud machines that were penetrating the walls. It was kind of ridiculous. So, you know, client reached out, said, I need a lawyer for this. I don't want to turn off my machines, but, you know, I could see where they're coming from. And we talked about it, and we basically figured out a way that the machines could be run quieter and less often. Luckily, the neighbors had a lawyer themselves, and frankly, I really like dealing with other lawyers more than people who are unrepresented, because lawyers understand the legal issues involved in these kinds of cases, so they don't get bogged down with emotions or things that aren't relevant. And so the deal we worked out was he signed a contract, essentially, an agreement, that if they dismissed their protection order petition, their restraining order petition, he would agree to these terms, which was keep the volume lower, don't run them as often, that kind of thing. And, you know, the flip side was we'd go to court and fight it out. Now, they had a pretty strong case and they knew it, but at the same time, there was no guarantee. This was basically a settlement offer where they gave up something, which was the possibility of a court-enforced order, and we gave up something, which was these machines being less loud, which is all they really wanted in the first place. And, you know, he might have had some mental health issues too, and they were sympathetic to that. So they agreed, and everybody signed the piece of paper that said, we're going to do these things, and the court petition was dismissed. Now, possibly, I could have won in court saying, you know, they didn't make their case and what have you, but I was probably going to lose it. So this was a way that my guy's record was kept clean and the other side got what they wanted. These civil orders, there's room for maneuvering, but just like calling the police, once the courts are involved and judges are making a decision, it's out of the people's hands. So a lot of the times I recommend if you need to get an order or someone's trying to get an order against you, if it makes sense under the circumstances, see if there's some kind of resolution that can be crafted that makes everybody happy, that you can personally decide, and you could personally vouch for that what everybody actually wants. Because if a judge makes a decision, it might not be what anybody wants, and that's just the risk you have when you have someone else being the decision maker. Ultimately, restraining orders happen. They are very common. If you're listening to this and you've never been the subject of a restraining order, you never need to get a restraining order, more power to you. That's great. I mean, I hope that stays true for your whole life. But it do happen. Sometimes you're trying to get scammed. Sometimes you're vulnerable. Or sometimes you need to get one. Or sometimes someone went too far and wants to get one against you. There are consequences to having an order placed against you. And for that reason, I do recommend people talk to an attorney at least about best practices about how to fight them if you're the subject of it. It comes up a lot, and it can be a big deal. People have gone to jail. Well, I hope my overview of restraining orders has been helpful. If there's a topic that you want to listen to, send me an email or post in the comments. I'm happy to talk about whatever legal issues people want to learn about. This was a popular one, like I said, but there's plenty of others. Until next time, this has been Noah Weil, and thanks for listening.